From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear the latest Listen MKE, which focuses on young people who are organizing and participating in the ongoing Milwaukee protests. Then our astronomy contributor shares her tips on how to best observe the Perseid meteor shower.
It seems to radiate from the direction of the Perseid constellation. That does not mean that the best thing to do is to look at the constellation.
Plus, Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company joins us to share his annual summer reading recommendations with a Wisconsin theme.
I think it's fun to have the local connections and, and books are just a great way of, as you said, vacationing without going away. And they're also a natural social distancing mechanism.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM is partnering with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee PBS, and the Milwaukee Public Library on an initiative we call Listen MKE. Its goal? Help Milwaukee's Northside residents get the information they want and need. More specifically, we want to better understand what's most important to people who live in these Milwaukee neighborhoods and help fill information gaps. For nearly 60 consecutive days, there have been protests in Milwaukee over racial justice and police brutality. At many of these protests, young people are center stage, not just as participants, but as organizers. In light of these protests, the Listen MKE team has hosted several recent Facebook Live events. In this latest installment of Listen MKE, WUWM's Latoya Dennis spoke with young organizers, Isabella Busby, Christopher Washington, and Melania Moore. Moore starts by explaining why the pandemic made this the perfect time for the fight against systemic racism.
I think for me and a lot of the other young people, it is being in this pandemic and seeing all the things that are happening via our cell phones, like locked in our rooms. Very angry because we saw a man die for 8 minutes and 56 seconds with a knee on his neck. I know that I was very young when Trayvon Martin first died, and ever since then, we've kind of just seen this ripple effect. And I think that people get really tired when they're told that they have to sit in one space in one area when they know that justice needs to be served and they're not doing anything. So I know that for me, I go out into the streets and I see like a lot of unity, and this kind of pushes us forward to keep wanting to fight for justice and fight for change, because we see that we as young people can actually do so. It's not actually that hard.
I want to bring in Chris and Bella on this conversation, right? Why this movement and why now? Whichever one of you want to take that first.
It was just seeing George Floyd was like the first time, because I'm 14, so when I was younger, I'd see this on the news, but I didn't completely understand the gravity of the situation. And so when I first saw George Floyd on the news, and then I saw all these people protesting and then all these people saying it was fake, that was really the point where it's like, I really need to do something. Because there's people in my community saying, oh, well, he was a criminal, like justifying this. So that was the breaking point for me, where I was like, I don't know why. Yeah, it was a big learning experience for me.
How do you feel when you hear people justify it?
That's exactly why my main goal is going to be working with the education system, because all those people that are justifying it don't understand what it's like to be Black in America. There's a difference. There's microaggressions, there's people that are racist but they don't understand why they're being racist, and there are people that are just flat out aggravated racists. And a lot of the people that were justifying George Floyd didn't completely understand why this was an issue. So that was also why I'm doing all this work, because people don't understand.
When you talk about the work you're doing, talk a little bit more about that. What have you done?
So I've been involved in a lot of the protests in Shorewood. So I've planned a lot of those. So I'll be a freshman this fall, and I'm gonna, the administration doesn't know this, but I am gonna be working on them with curriculum because there's not enough minority groups shown in the teachings throughout elementary, middle, and high school. So that's what I'm gonna be focusing on.
Where do you go to school? What district are you in?
I'm in Shorewood, so I'm going to Shorewood High School.
And Chris, what about you? Why now?
I also went to Shorewood. So it was like, it's really powerful to see, like, you know, that continuation of like, of Black activism. Cause you know, a lot at Shorewood, Black voices are, they're kind of just like put in the background for a lot of years. And I noticed that. And it like, it was really hurtful. And we really fought for that spotlight, literally on stage. For me, this fight right now is important because, you know, when you have discussions with a lot of people, one thing a lot of people don't really talk about is there's this weird sort form of numbness when it comes to speaking about police brutality and gun violence. This numbness meaning like people, of course, people are sick of it. People are tired of it and it's hurting them. But it's like a lot of people are done talking about it. A lot of people, you know, they don't really have that energy to keep moving forward. And for me, I was personally waiting for it. I was waiting for something to blow up to like, to, you know, amplify this fight because I'm just here to amplify voices. I'm just, a lot of people see like our protests as anger or as frustration, but really it's just loudness. It's loudness coming from people who just haven't been heard before.
I want to go back and I want to talk about something that was mentioned earlier. There was a word thrown out and that word was justice, right? We're marching for justice. That's what we're seeking in this time. I'm wondering for each of you, what does justice actually look like? Chris, you want to take that first?
For me, justice looks like instead of our governor assuming that we are coming out of aggression and that we are, our intention is to riot and destroy our city and send the National Guard on protesters and Black people in our community. Instead of doing that, I think he should apologize. And I think instead he should come from a place of understanding. For me, justice means understanding and listening. A lot of people are marching. It's because it's giving that like that shy person a pinch. Maybe there's like this shy kid who goes to an all-white conservative school who came in like and jumped in our march. And he started yelling chants and everybody was repeating after him and everybody was following him. And it was really empowering to see him gain that confidence and being a part of a number.
Bella, what about you?
I just think justice is respect for minority groups that like microaggressions just at school are Black kids and brown kids and all minority groups. Shouldn't have to grow up and just deal with being disrespected and just hurt on a daily basis. Justice is the respect for Black kids.
Now, you've used this word a couple of times during this conversation, microaggression. What do you mean by that?
I have to deal with that every day. It's people being like, oh, you're pretty for a Black person, or you don't sound like a Black person, or I'm almost as dark as you, I'm almost Black. And just small stuff that isn't aggressive and trying to hurt me, but still is like not okay to say.
There's a lot of that at Shorewood.
Oh my gosh, it's too much. It's really, because Shorewood's such a great school district. We've got a lot of great teachers, but that, the area of race in the school, they really just let us down.
Yeah.
So when you say you want to start with education, Bella, and pushing the school district on that, what does that look like for you?
Well, I remember growing up in like elementary school when it was Black History Month, we'd learn about Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, occasionally Malcolm X, and they were all great people, but that was really it. It was a focus on them, then we wouldn't talk about them for the rest of the year. And I think that's where a lot of the miseducation in kids comes from, because they're not educated on Black people whatsoever. Black people know about Black people because our parents and we're just Black. But white kids, that's also white people don't know about that. That's not something they have to worry about. It's not something they have to learn about at home. They don't have to, their parents don't talk to them about what to do when they're pulled over. And yeah, it's just, there's so much that you have to learn about as a Black kid that white people should also learn about and respect, that we have to learn about. It's a whole education thing that everybody needs to be educated so that can stop some of the microaggressions in school.
Malena, what does justice look like to you?
I think I agree a lot with what they both said. Mine started with education as well, because a lot of white people right now, it seems like even so are like, whoa, racism? It's like a whole thing. So a lot of people are like asking now, oh, Black people, like, what can we do? And it's like, you have to go out and understand for yourself what this country is built on. So I also think it's about, you know, really looking at the history of our country, really assessing what happened and what continues to happen and has happened throughout this entire time. You know, a lot of people just ignore everything that happens to Black people. And, you know, it's there's microaggressions, there's, you know, there's the housing, there's the poverty and the homelessness, there's the criminal justice system, you know. So there's a lot that need to be looked at and reassessed. I definitely think that we need to look at the way that the police are trained, how long they're trained, how they're, like, what they're trained on. I think that there can be a lot more of those resources and the money that goes into police that is put into education and our school systems, you know, so that we can teach people about, you know, the things that they need to know. And justice also, like, arresting cops who are senselessly murdering people or murdering people at all. I never think that ever, ever, ever needs to be the result of police contact with civilians. They should be trained to de-escalate situations and not murder people. It's murder.
So we've been talking about education and what justice looks like, right? And how we get there. How do we get there? I'm wondering, there's been a question, not really a question. What I've been noticing a lot about this movement right now versus previous movements are the allies, right? This doesn't just seem like an issue for Black people to deal with. You look at the front lines of many of the protests that we see today, and on the front lines, in some cases, are white people. There are tons of Black people, obviously, but there are a lot of white people who are out there supporting, who are putting their lives and their backs on the line too. I wonder how important you guys see that as being for this movement.
Oh, it's very important.
Yeah.
Very important. At our march, we had, when we signed waivers, when we were making those papers, everyone got to sign this, everyone got to sign that. We made it very clear that our allies are allies. Our allies do not lead our movements. Our allies do not lead our voices. Our allies are allies. And what's important in that is because a lot of times, when you lead a march and when you lead a movement, sometimes that message gets construed when people who are allies, they try to, not purposely, but they kind of lead that voice. And it's dangerous when people who do not experience what we experience lead a cause that fights for what we experience.
Yeah, someone made a speech at our Sword protest. They were talking about how being an ally, being a white ally to Black Lives Matter is cute, but you have to stick to it. You can't just make the con, you can't just be like Black Lives Matter and then just leave it at that. You have to support Black businesses. You have to say to your family, hey, you can't say that, that's racist. You can't just say Black Lives Matter, post a picture on Instagram and be done with it.
Performative activism, yeah.
Malena, what are your thoughts on that, on the importance of allies?
I think it's important that white people are there because, like you said, Christopher, don't lead mine, but they also are the ones that, you know, have the most power to change. We talk about these protests being great because they amplify our voices, but at the same time, they need to hear what we have to say so that they can help us go out and actually change these things. Yeah. Because we have a lot of power, we have a lot of voice. At the end of the day, we do know that there are a lot of white people who will walk and try to not let us in and give us what we are asking for. So it is important that we have those white allies to help amplify our voices as well.
Yeah, the sad truth is that they're not going to listen unless it's someone that they can relate to. You know, like they'll be like, you can see like with the media, the way they report on like white protests and black protests, and we really do need, you also need the white person there just so that they don't call you like thugs and rioters. It's sad, but.
One thing we said in our march is like, if this was a fight for climate change, there'd be a lot less police.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see it in my own village. There were not as many police when we were doing the Shorewood March, because it was primarily white people, because I promise you there's not that many black people in Shorewood. But, and then there'd be protests coming through Shorewood, coming from Milwaukee. They brought out all the giant like tanks, I don't know what they're called, and just way too much. There was almost no police. There was like maybe one police car at our protest during the day at Shorewood. And then they were just there to make sure no cars hit us or anything. And then when it was like primarily black people coming through Shorewood, they brought out everything. It was like Wauwatosa, all these police departments all over Shorewood came in because they didn't have enough police in Shorewood enough to stop these protesters.
You know, there's one more question from people who are watching that I'd like to jump in. We are running a little short on time, but that is, do you think that local elected officials are representing your views?
I personally don't think so.
Yeah, I can tell you the police departments aren't supporting us.
I want to stress the fact that Milwaukee is two things. Milwaukee is a majority Democratic elected city, but it is also the most segregated city in the United States. These two combinations, it shows us that identity politics isn't working anymore. What I'm saying is that there's a flaw in our voting system, and I think we need to address that seriously. There's a flaw, there's like a lot of people feel that the elected officials are not representing our views. And a lot of people are tired of just voting for a lesser of two evils. It's a difficult situation.
So if that's the case, then what do you do, right? If you don't want to, if you're saying we're tired of voting for the lesser of two evils, but there's no one there representing our views, what do you do? Should we expect a run from you?
No. But I think I've grown up in an area where when you couldn't eat, you ate at the church. When you had nowhere else to go, there were a lot of churches and there are a lot of schools that became houses and homes and food banks. And I think when our government fails us, I think it's the duty of our community to take charge. Yeah. And that's where I've seen a lot of progress.
Yeah, we also need to elect people that can relate to what's going on. Because no matter how hard, like, every white ally, they can support all they want, but they'll never completely understand what it's like to be Black in America. So it's so important to get diversity, not just Black, but everybody in government seats where they've experienced everything and they know what's right for their community because they've been less fortunate and they didn't grow up in a giant house with so much money and no issues at all. So it's so important that there's diversity in the government.
That was Isabella Busby, Christopher Washington, and Melania Moore, all young activists and protest organizers here in Milwaukee. Listen MKE is a partnership of WUWM, the Journal Sentinel, Milwaukee Public Library, and Milwaukee PBS. The full conversation will air tonight on Channel 10 at 7:30 p.m. You can also find it at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we share some tips on how to best observe the Perseid meteor shower. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every year, the Perseid meteor shower is one of the highlights of summer stargazing. It started about a week ago and will peak August 11th through the 13th. These meteors are debris left by the passing Swift-Tuttle comet burning in the Earth's atmosphere, and the Perseids are known for bright, frequent meteor sightings. Our astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about this annual meteor shower and how to best see it. She begins by explaining what exactly meteor showers are made of.
Your typical shooting star starts the size, it's a little piece of debris about the size of a grain of sand. It enters the atmosphere of the Earth going about 80,000 miles an hour. And that is such a shock, if you will, that it makes the air around it glow. And that's what we see as those quick streaks of light. Now, it turns out that certain times of the year, we can predict that we're going to have more than usual shooting stars. So any night, any time, as long as it's clear, they're about five an hour on average. But a few times a year, there could be 100 or more. That's what we call a meteor shower, because there's so many of them. And we know when that's going to happen. We can predict it because the Earth travels through the orbit of a comet. And although we're not going to get anywhere close to the comet, we are going to go through the debris that the comet leaves behind. And that's why we can say, oh, between the 11th and the 12th of August, we will see more meteor showers than usual.
And just how shooting stars and meteors are connected, you touched upon the comet, and the Perseids occurring annually are made of the debris from the comet Swift-Tuttle. So is there a slight difference or a connection similar to how shooting stars and meteors are connected of the connection or difference between a meteor and a comet?
Okay, so a meteor is a very local phenomenon that happens because a small amount of debris enters our atmosphere, right? So that's a very local thing. Nobody outside the Earth's atmosphere would be able to see that. A comet is a sometimes a mile across frozen kind of, they're sometimes described as dirty ice. So these can be much larger things that as they approach the sun, some of their material is going to evaporate, leaving behind this beautiful tail. And comets can take dozens of years to go around the sun, or hundreds or thousands of years, depending on what kind of comet it is. So the connection between comets and shooting stars is that some of that debris that entered the atmosphere could be from a comet, because comets shed material all the time. But the other possibility is that it comes from an asteroid, because asteroids, there are lots and lots of asteroids in the solar system. Sometimes they bang into each other. Even a glancing hit will produce debris that eventually can find itself near the atmosphere of the Earth. And a further connection, what's kind of cool too, is that the material that make up asteroids tends to be sturdier than the stuff of comets. So if a little bit of a comet comes into our atmosphere, it's not going to survive to hit the ground. But an asteroid, which is made of more rocky material, is more likely to survive. It's not certain, but it's more likely to survive. And if it does hit the ground, we call that a meteorite, because we might pick it up. I like to think of it as.
That is a good, handy way to remember it.
So yeah.
With the Perseids, it has a connection to the constellation Perseus. So why is this shower named after that?
Because it seems to radiate from the direction of the Perseid constellation. That does not mean that the best thing to do is to look at the constellation. Generally speaking, the best way to see a meteor shower is to have as expansive a horizon as you can so that you can see as much as possible. It's been now a few years, but I saw a really nice, what we call a fireball. So from time to time, if the piece of debris is about the size of an orange, then what it produces is much brighter and it will outshine a planet. Then we call it a fireball. And the other nice thing about the Perseids, other than it's in mid-August and the weather is decent and it's nice to be outside and sitting around for some time, the other nice thing about it is we seem to have activity for several days on either side. So it's not like one of these events where if it's cloudy on the 11th of August, then you're toast. That's not how it works. You might have just as good a chance to see reasonable meteors, you know, days on either side of that.
What are your tips about how you can best view a meteor shower? You mentioned it's an every night occurrence, but when we're in the city and used to a certain amount of light pollution, what's the best way to really take advantage of these astronomical events?
I think the key point is to be comfortable. People don't realize that if I'm sitting, like there's only so much I can look up without getting my neck hurting, right? So ideally you would want to have a situation where you can recline, you can look up without putting any stress on your neck. And that could be a lawn chair. If it's warm enough, I guess you can put a couple of blankets and lie down. The practical advice that people give is if you're still for any long period of time, the temperature feels 20 degrees cooler than what the thermometer says. So bring something to put on, and obviously put some mosquito repellent because the mosquitoes will have a wonderful time too. Maybe they've booked the Perseid shower too as a good meal time. And I think the key with meteor showers is to be prepared to watch the sky for some time. It's not one of those things where, you know, I'm going to give this 5 minutes to perform for me. It's not like an eclipse where it really is. This is it. I'm going to focus for 8 minutes. It's nice to relax, you know, chat with your friends, just look up and you'll be rewarded reasonably well. And even if you're not, I mean, the nice thing about gazing at the night sky is that you'll get to enjoy a beautiful sky, and Mars is up as well. I mean, there are other things to look for in addition to meteor showers. So that would be my advice. Make yourself comfortable, be prepared to sit there for a while.
You mentioned on an average night, it's about 5 shooting stars that we'll see an hour. So given this Perseid shower, at its peak in August, on average, how many can people see in an hour during this specific event?
People sometimes make predictions, this is not what I do for a living. You know, sometimes they'll say, oh, it's going to be a good one. Oh, maybe it's not going to be so good. I'm not going to repeat any of that because I find that if you set people up for, oh, this is going to be your life's, you know, meteor shower experience, then invariably they're disappointed. I would say if you see 5 good ones, if you happen to be looking up for, you know, an hour or so, an hour and a half, and I know that you might think, well, that's contradicting, Jean. You just told us that it's 5 an hour anyway. Yeah. But you have to be looking at the right place at the right time to see the 5 in an hour. I say if you see 5 good ones, then you can call it a day. And you can stay longer, of course, if you like. But I think if you see 5 beautiful meteors, that's pretty good. Most of us don't get to see that on a daily basis. Usually the claim is that you can see, you know, dozens, 20, 40. But in reality, if you don't have a super duper dark sky, we also have issues with haze, with high humidity. I mean, the atmosphere might not be as crisp as it might be in other places. So I would say if you, as I said, you see 5, 10 really good ones, you scored.
Well, if anything, I think this time has taught us a little more patience and to take advantage of local field trips. So I think this is a great place to start.
Great. Yeah, I do hope that people will take that opportunity. And, you know, sometimes we get unlucky and the clouds come up and you think, So I would say, here's my other piece of advice. Rather than spending a whole lot of time driving for hours and hours and hours, and then you've really made an investment and the stakes are high, I would say it's better to drive not quite so far, but being prepared perhaps to do it twice if the weather betrays you as you're going there, which can happen. That would be my suggestion. Try to avoid putting too many eggs in one basket. Go twice.
Excellent advice. Well, Jean, thank you so much.
Thank you, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, and she's our regular astronomy contributor. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find our past conversations about astronomy at WUWM.com. After the break, we'll get some summer reading recommendations from Boswell Books. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Summertime looks and feels a bit different for many of us during this pandemic. There aren't a lot of festivals or big trips, but there is definitely time for reading. As we all spend more time at home, having a good book to help pass the time can be a necessity. And if you don't know what to pick up next, Daniel Golden of Boswell Book Company has plenty of recommendations. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share his annual summer reading list.
Daniel Golden, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Oh, it is an honor to virtually be there.
It's great to virtually have you. And although we are, of course, having a little bit of a different summertime this year, you know, I still wanted to keep our tradition of a Boswell summer book list because, you know, we've been emphasizing on keeping things very local in our lives, whether keeping our circles small or travel for the health and safety of others. But fortunately, books can also take us many places while we're spending more time at home. So what theme does this year's summer reading list follow?
Well, I did actually try to go with a local connections list just because if people are traveling, most people are traveling by car, so they're probably not going to go out of state. And the other reason I like to support our own, and I sort of think it's fun to have the local connections. And, you know, and books are just a great way of, as you said, vacationing without going away. And they're also a natural social distancing mechanism.
Exactly, the first. So let's start off right away. Your first book on the list is The King of Confidence by Miles Harvey.
Yes, this is one of my nonfiction picks. I think it might be my nonfiction pick. And it is sort of a narrative nonfiction with a little true crime for people who like Eric Larson or David Gran. And it's super local because it is about a gentleman named James Strang who decided that he was the second coming of Joseph Smith after his passing and set up actually his original headquarters in Burlington, just, I don't know, southwest of Milwaukee. Afterwards, he and his followers took over an island in Lake Michigan, Beaver Island, which is, I don't know how the, it might be on the Michigan side, but it's pretty close to Washington Island, where they basically set up their own, almost like a government, and did a little counterfeiting, a little stealing of what you call consecration, which is where you steal in the name of your religion from non-believers and tried to make a go of it. At the time, it's the mid 19th century, 1850s. So this book ties into so many of the trends that were going on then. And the religious revivalism, which ties into the story, was actually happening all across the country. And I just thought it was great.
So another book in the ties of historical events, we have Cher Ami and Major Whittlesley by Catherine Rooney. And this one was very intriguing to me.
This is sort of almost history. It's historical fiction. It is based on a true story. Whittlesley was a commander in the Lost Battalion incident of World War I. And he actually grew up in Florence, Wisconsin, which is, I'm going to say it, it's in the middle of nowhere. It's actually pretty close. It's also on the border of Michigan. It's in, I think the closest city I'd heard of was Iron Mountain, Michigan. I think in about 10, his family moved to Massachusetts. So the story is told from the perspective of Whittlesey. The Lost Battalion was when, in World War I in France, this battalion was pretty much surrounded. And as in most war tactics of the day, probably would have been abandoned, except that they got so much media attention from newspapers that the government had to go in and save them. The story is told alternatingly by Cher Ami, which was an actual pigeon in World War I, a carrier pigeon, which was really pre-internet, pre-phone, you know, this is the way that troops communicated with each other. And this is a pigeon that went from the Lost Battalion to the base after losing a leg and an eye. And that pigeon is actually in the Smithsonian Museum. And I'm going to say it, the story is told from the pigeon's, or at least half the story is. It's a great World War I story. She really brings both characters to life. It's actually a story a little bit about queerness, because she posits that Whittlesey was probably a closeted gay man. And weirdly enough, Cher Ami was a female pigeon that was given a male name. And she reads a little into that, but there you go.
Yeah, it intrigues me that the narratives go between a human and a pigeon.
You know, I'm really into the animal perspective. So there was a book earlier this year I really loved called The Story of a Goat, which was a big book in India. That goat went through a lot.
Yeah. We'll save it for another reading list.
I don't know the local connection.
Well, and then also a book that is based on a character story that is popularized is called Bonnie by Christina Schwartz.
This is Christina Schwartz's fifth novel. In this case, it's a historical fiction based on the life of Bonnie Parker, who people know with Clyde Barrow, did a number of robberies around the country. I will say, it doesn't look like they did much in Wisconsin, if they did anything. It doesn't come up in the book. However, Christina Schwartz did a lot in Wisconsin because she grew up in, I'm going to say it, the publisher said she grew up in rural Wisconsin. So I said, what the heck does rural Wisconsin mean? So of course I needed to know more. So I said, where'd you grow up? And she said, I grew up in Pewaukee, Delafield, and Heartland, depending on whether you're considering mailing address, voting district, or school orientation. So we do a lot of that stuff. Like why is a little bit of New Berlin in the West Allis school district? I do not know. So in any case, she really brings the character to life. Very different from the film version. She didn't watch the film at all. There's a lot of research on Bonnie and Clyde. She actually left a bunch of papers in a motel. They had her poetry, and she really focuses in on the poetry. This is not a bored housewife the way pictured in the film. She is a woman of thwarted ambition who was successful in school until she was basically cut down by a teacher, but she continued to write poetry her whole life. And what Schwartz does is really make the drudgery, like what this was. It's like we think of like glamorous bank robbing, but no, it was mostly like gas stations and drug stores. And once they hold up a gumball machine to get the pennies. So, it's also, the relationship is very complicated, and it's really from her perspective. Clyde is really more of an enigma. And really great, lots of research. She went all over the place to do research on the book. Great historical fiction.
And next on our list, we have The Second Home by Christina Clancy.
Well, no history here, though there's a little bit of Milwaukee history. This book is a super Milwaukee book. You wouldn't know it from the cover copy because the publishers don't really care that much about Wisconsin. So for their perspective, it's about three siblings fighting over the family summer house on Cape Cod. But what we don't know is what we know is that the first house, the parents have died, is also up for grabs. That's in Milwaukee. The truth is nobody wants that one. So it's a fighting sibling story. There's two siblings from birth, and they adopt a third kid, a troubled high school kid, when the parents are teaching at Riverside High School. Because the truth is that one of the characters in this book, Poppy, her like arc is to learn to love her home, which is she goes back to Milwaukee and falls in love with it again. I've gotten a few like ecstatic texts from people because Boswell gets mentioned in the book. So, you know, this is where my heart is. Christina Clancy has been a friend of the store since we opened. She grew up in Whitefish Bay. She was in the UWM Creative Writing Graduate Program where she got her doctorate. She was teaching at Beloit. Oh my gosh, within the first 100 days, she said to me, I'm gonna write a book and I'm gonna do my launch at Boswell. And I thought, well, good for you, so am I. But she actually did it, except of course Boswell was not open because of COVID. So instead, we did a virtual launch, but she did come in and sign books when people weren't there and posted a lot of photos of that. So, and one day we'll have her reset launch, or maybe for her next book, because she's already written the next book, which is so exciting. It's also set in Wisconsin.
Things to hold off for the future. Do you have any favorites?
Let's see. Yes, I have a favorite. And once again, the story is not set in Wisconsin, maybe his next one, but the author is a full-time Wisconsinite. It's The Coyotes of Carthage by Stephen Wright. It is sort of an atmospheric political thriller, I guess you'd say, set in South Carolina. This African-American man who's a political operative is basically sent to this very conservative, mostly white town to convince them, to get them to vote on an ordinance that would give up their local historic mountain for mining purposes. If you have good film history knowledge, you might know that's sort of the plot of a book story called The Local Hero in the 80s by Bill Forsyth, which I loved. But unlike that one, there's not a lot of heart and warmth. It really, it's just dark and moody and almost like, it's not action-packed. It's almost more like a spy thriller as he puts in the folks on the ground who sometimes do what he wants and sometimes don't do what he wants. And he's a guy on his last chance. You know, he's got a prison sentence. He's got a brother who's dying. He's got a backstory that we don't know about. The writing's so good. Wright teaches at UW Madison's law school, and he also teaches in the creative writing program. And he's got a lot of lawyers that he's trained working in Milwaukee. He's also the co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Fund. So I love the book and I love him.
All right. And then let's go to...
Let's go with Liza Beattie Pritchard, just because I just finished it yesterday.
Okay. It's nice and fresh. The Liza Beattie Pritchard.
I remember Larry Watson is like, it's funny because he only had one book set in Wisconsin. The Orchard. Everything else is in North Dakota, Montana, Western Minnesota. But he's a Wisconsin writer. He's taught at UW Stevens Point and then at Marquette for many years. And he has just retired, but he didn't retire out of state. He retired to Kenosha. This book, like all of his books of late, the last few books, has this very powerful older hero, in this case, Edie Pritchard. And the story is told in three moments of her life, basically connected to her three marital statuses. It's almost like a literary triptych. And each one has that quiet suspense that Watson is known for. That his book, Let Him Go, is actually gonna be a film with Kevin Costner and Diane Lane. It was supposed to come out like right now, but of course it's been delayed in the fall. But he just like, his books have like really great roles for older women and men. In this case, she has three confrontations. The first with two brothers fighting over her. The second with trying to escape her second marriage to visit the first husband who's dying. And the third one when her granddaughter visits with her boyfriend and his really unpleasant, bad seed brother. So really terrific book. because it's a triptych, it's got a different pacing from his other novels, which usually just build. But this, think of it as reading three great novels.
So what about Real Life, which is a novel by Brandon Taylor?
Well, this was a book that was not quite on my radar at first. And then the Sherwood Reads people who were looking for authors and books for their next, whenever that's going to be, put something on the notice saying that one of them read Real Life by Brandon Taylor and really liked it. And I thought, okay, I'll try it. So I bought a copy because actually I knew who to give it to afterwards. It's an academic novel about a Black grad student who comes to an unnamed college town. Nothing is ever mentioned in the story to indicate where it is, and yet you know exactly where it is. Like I could walk the walk, Madison, which was so much fun. And he's a Black grad student in a sea of white people. He's gay. He develops a relationship with this closeted other grad student. He has so little support. He gets accused of sexism by another student, which does get a lot of attention, unlike the racism that he is continually faced with in his own practice. And it's a really a book for the moment, even though he didn't know he was writing it for the moment, because it looks at like allyship and what a white person can do to support a Black person, you know, because what happens is the guy who's the lover knows what's happening is bad, but only can apologize to him afterwards. It is definitely a coming of age story, a book about a gay person also in a straight world a bit, and beautifully written. Definitely, you can tell he went through the UW-Madison creative writing program where Stephen Wright teaches, as well as Quan Berry, who's another wonderful writer. And there's some similarities to Stephen Wright's book in that it's sort of like, once again, a Black person kind of immersed in a white world.
And lastly, we have Weird But Normal by Mia Mercado.
This is one of my nonfiction picks. So this is, if you look at the book, it's like, oh, it has a quote from Samantha Irby, who is a wonderful writer who just had a number one bestseller. And she visited Boswell a couple of times when she lived in Chicago for her previous book. And in this case, it's the perfect match. Mia Mercado is a blogger who actually has amazing Milwaukee roots. She grew up in Glendale, and Grafton, which I learned in the book. She mentioned, talks about a little bit about her childhood. And then, I know this is ridiculous, but I went on her, I was like, she went to college in three places. I'm like, and you don't really get a handle on where she went to college. I actually looked at her LinkedIn page. She went to UWM! So here we are in the UWM station and we have to celebrate the graduates. So they're humorous essays and some of them are really silly about inventorying your clothing and how she, as you can see from the book, she's has a particularly hairy body, but also it's about being a biracial Asian woman in a white world. So she is half Filipina, and she, as I said, grew up in Grafton, and she talks a lot about the things that people say that are inappropriate to her, and often in a very funny way about this. It's something also that we should always have been aware of, but I think we're even more aware of now. I laughed out loud several times. And I would say that in addition to Samantha Irby, I would say Jenny Lawson, especially because Mercado talks about her bout with depression. And for those a little older, Jen Lancaster, who was a big blogger, a number of best-selling titles. So I think any of them would find the book really enjoyable.
And with all these great book recommendations, I'm just curious about how you and Boswell is doing amidst the pandemic. What kind of changes have you had to undergo? And you know, bookstores were struggling and noted to be a struggling industry before this happened. So how have you been able to adjust?
You know, it's every day is a new, you kind of start again. We're very lucky compared to some kinds of independent stores because many independent bookstores have pretty vibrant websites, not due to our own success, but because we work with our trade association, the American Booksellers Association. We canceled months of events and it took us probably 6 weeks to figure out how to pivot virtual. So now we're doing a lot of virtual events, but they're very different. They all have to be in conversation. I often have to, you know, we can't always find a partner. So I was like, oh, I'm doing another one. we went to curbside pickup, then we went to sidewalk. We've done a lot of shipping, and that's at the whims of UPS and the post office. We thought we might open for browsing, but now the numbers are going a funny way. So honestly, you know, it's really day to day. What I'll exactly do. I do have very beautiful protective plastic installed. There's so many lists of things that you really need to do to be safe for everybody. So, you know, now we're thinking about our air conditioning unit and how many people can we have in the store? So we haven't done really any programs in the store at all, but some of my friends at other bookstores have. We're certainly not the only bookstore that's not doing browsing, but some are doing them. But the way the numbers look, I can't really say what things will look like next week. So for somebody like me who doesn't like change, who doesn't adapt well, this has been like continuous adaptation. And I was like, well, I got no choice. So I want all the people we love to be safe. We want all our book lovers to be safe, but we want to provide books for folks as well. And so after I'm done talking to you, I'll probably be running around dropping books in people's storm doors and going to the post office to mail a whole bunch of things all over the place. So.
Well, Daniel, I want to thank you for your time to put this together and to still share your passion and love of books and reading with our listeners and for us to connect with you in this way.
Oh, it's my favorite program. Honored to be on it.
Daniel Golden is the proprietor of Boswell Book Company on Downer Avenue here in Milwaukee. You can find the full summer reading list and see past ones at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Angelina Mosher Salazar join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Latoya Dennis and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. And Michelle Matanowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.